Working Cows Podcast, episode 302. This episode is brought to you by Understanding Ag.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, recorded exclusively in the C90 Ocean Minerals Studios. And this episode is brought to you by Understanding Ag, and they facilitated a conversation with Burke Teichert. This is part two of that conversation. In the first part, we talked a lot about some of the things that make up a successful ranch manager, some of the key ratios that they should pay attention to, some of the things that are major determinants of financial success, and what we as ranchers manage and what we should be paying attention to. So I encourage you to go back and look at that. It'll be linked in the show notes page for today. The show notes page for today is workingcows.net/302. workingcows.net/302 is the show notes page for today. You can find last week's episode or last time's episode there. It will be also at workingcows.net/299. So you can go there and listen to that episode and then come back and finish this conversation here. But first, we're going to review a little bit of what we talked about with Burke last time, and then we're going to jump in and we're going to talk about some of, you know, what role soil health plays in ranch management, as well as how Burke got into regenerative management, and, you know, then a rapid fire round towards the end. We're going to talk to him about cow size and how to match that to the environment, and EPDs and managing bull costs and all kinds of these things that he thinks have been important to what's made him successful over the years. So really looking forward to this conversation with Burke. Burke, thanks again for joining me on the Working Cows podcast. Welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So on the last episode, we talked a lot about management and what we should be managing and some of those things. And we finished up by talking a little bit about soil health and what role it plays in ranch management. But could you kind of give us a review there and kind of refresh our memory about some of the things we talked about with regard to soil health?
Yes, I can. I don't think anything, except perhaps excellence in marketing, has a greater effect on ranch profitability than does soil health. Mm. Now, we talked about the things you need to manage, production, economics, finance, marketing, and people. But soil health, except for perhaps marketing, underpins production, and it is a huge, huge driver. It enables you to reduce overheads. It enables you to increase turnover, especially reduce overheads on a per cow basis, but it usually helps you reduce overheads in general, overall. It helps you reduce acres per cow or improves your stocking rate because your herds get bigger, but it's not more herds. It's just how many of the herds you choose to have. They get bigger, and as they get bigger, the number of cows that one person or cows per full-time equivalent of labor can increase. And so salary and all the attendant costs of salary, the housing, the insurance, if you help with that, the tools, the vehicles, the horses, all of the things that hover around an employee, all those costs are spread across more cows and or sheep or whatever you have. And it can just spread so much further. And soil health is the catalyst. It's the driver. It's where all of that begins and what makes it all happen. And then when that all happens, then fed feed versus grazed feed, you just don't have to feed as many days in the year. You can graze for more of them.
What are some of the improvements in soil health that you have learn to keep an eye on? What are some of the things that kind of indicate these things are making a turn here?
You just start to observe a lot of things. And First of all, the improvement of soil health, I don't think it ever needs to end. At least I've not seen the situation where it looks like it's coming to an end. I think it can just continue. You know, I'd like to say forever, but that's a pretty big word. I don't know. But in my lifetime, and you're a lot younger than I, and in your lifetime, I don't think we're going to see improvements in soil health come to an end for people who are truly good grazers or good farmers. You know, you kick into motion compounding and cascading events. You first start to improve cover, which starts to let more rainfall go into the ground, which starts to improve aggregation, which lets even more rainfall get into the ground. And as that happens, more plant material begins to grow. Plants begin to root deeper and reach deeper into the soil. Old seeds that have been in the latent seed bank begin to sprout. Diversity begins to improve. And then types of rooting. And so Alan talks about compounding and cascading events. There's no singular effect. So you make one change and you don't just get one result. You get multiple results. And then those cascade forward. They just keep rolling forward. And so we keep looking for ways to improve what we do and come more closely to fully obeying the principles of soil health and to more fully using the rules of adaptive grazing, adaptive management. And as we do that, we just have an ongoing and profound effect on ecosystem function, which means water is cycling. There's a huge solar panel out there of grass leaves, green leaves that can absorb sunlight and cause photosynthesis to occur. We have very, very little sunlight once we get advanced. Very little sunlight ever hits bare ground. It hits a leaf and turns into something useful. So these kind of things begin to happen. Variety begins to increase, and it happens fairly soon that you start seeing plants that you hadn't seen. Now, some of those might be weeds or forbs, which we like to call weeds, but they're filling a role for Mother Nature. We're trying to wake up land that was maybe kind of dead, and maybe that weed is the thing that can come and help it the most, the quickest, and get it started. And sometimes it's putting things into the soil that the soil needs. Sometimes it's bringing things from a little deeper into the soil. And with its leaf drop and with what goes through the cattle and what's put back onto the soil from manure and urine is something that surface of the soil needs. So all kinds of things. It is so complex, we don't understand it all. We understand quite a bit of it, but observation is just telling us that it all moves and it all happens. And everything is interconnected in this whole process. Everything is interconnected. And so I'm to where I say soil health doesn't cost, it pays. Mm-hmm. Most ranchers find that they can pay for the few things they need to buy to graze better with almost immediate cost savings and sales of unnecessary overheads. Now, that doesn't happen every time, but most of the time it happens. You sell overheads that you don't need, reduce overheads that you don't need, and then cost savings. You don't use as much fly control. You don't spray as many weeds, et cetera. You just start reducing all of that stuff. You don't use as much synthetic fertility. You let the animals do the fertilizing. So as that all starts to happen, it's only seldom that your costs outrun your revenue, and then that doesn't last very long when it happens if you're doing things pretty much right. The revenues come along, the cost savings continue to increase, and it just gets better. And so what it's doing is building resilience into your system. Resilience for either climate or market extremes. Mm-hmm. That drought, storm, bad winter, market ups and downs, you're just putting together a system which has all kinds of resilience to either climatic or biological or market extremes.
You can install a lot of fence and water infrastructure for the cost of the baler that you sold at the auction, right?
That's right. Now, some places the water might cost a little more than that sold baler. But if you're selling a tractor with a lot of horsepower and a baler and maybe a rake, that'll even build a fair amount of water line. But stock water and stock water placement, that's the biggest problem for starting to graze well. Mm-hmm. I'm working with some ranches in Wyoming right now, and stock water is a big issue. And, we're not harvesting near as many ADAs out of those pastures as they're presently constituted as we could if we had water in more places in those pastures, and then we could graze with more stock density and get the animals to graze where we wanted them to graze without having to ask them to go a long ways to water or without having to haul water to them. So we're in the process of developing that water so we can increase the stock density and do the things we need. But so our first gain will actually come in using more of the ranch better than what we've been using it. Mm-hmm. And then following that, because we'll put principles into practice, as we can start adopting practices that obey those principles more closely, then we will start to produce more feed. Initially, we don't even need to produce more feed. We just need to use what we have better.
Yeah, we get away from that overgrazing and undergrazing happening in the same paddock, right?
Yeah, right. Once we can break that up, then wonderful things are going to begin to happen.
So it's always, I always love listening to you. And I think one of my favorite things about listening to you is the fact that you are, as you said in the previous episode, you display a commitment to lifelong learning, and much of what you've shared with us in the last few minutes since we started this episode, I would say you weren't there when you were first exposed to Alan Savory in the late 70s. So can you talk to me a little bit about your journey through regenerative management, your journey into regenerative management?
Yeah, and I've got to tell you that Alan Savory is what kicked that off for me and started me down the road of holistic thinking. And luckily, for some reason or other, I was born more with that kind of a brain than I was a linear brain. Mm. Introductory courses, college, were always the hardest for me. Once I got foundation established, then adding to that was easy, because after that, it started getting interconnectedness and relationships, and I could start to see how one thing related to another and tied to another, and that came easier for me. But and so I'm glad that I had that little difficulty with linear learning and a little more facility with holistic thinking and systems thinking, because it's blessed me. But Savory got me moved in that direction. And I went to some of his schools back in Albuquerque, New Mexico, years and years ago, and met some good people there. And some of those people I actually brought to our ranches in Nebraska when I first started managed there to teach us schools right there on site. And work with us, work with our guys, and get them going. And at the same time, I had met ranchers from Nebraska in those schools. And when I went to Nebraska in 1990, I immediately made contact with as many of these people as I could remember and get to, and went and visited their ranches, saw what they were doing, and once I was comfortable with what they were doing and how they were doing it, and they were at least on the right track, I started taking our crew, our people, to see their ranches. And we could kind of see what they were doing. We could avoid some electric fence mistakes that they had made. And we could become believers that an electric fence really can hold those cows where they belong. That long ago, why everybody didn't want to believe that an electric fence would hold those cows, but they do. Mm. And so then I had one foreman in particular. He said, well, shouldn't we be starting to do this? And I said, yep, I think we should. Are you willing to dive in? And he said, yep. And so we started, and And it kind of grew from there. And then, so we'd visit other ranchers. If I thought I knew of somebody that was doing a good job, we just go visit. If I could hear of a good short course taking place someplace, we'd go. Or we'd bring people to our ranch if we could. And when we brought people to our ranch, we'd usually invite neighbors. Now, you know, takes a pretty good mindset. So a lot of those ranchers weren't particularly interested in coming, but some did. And so it was kind of fun that way. We could spread our costs and let the neighbors share a little bit with us and do those things. But that's kind of how we got started. And then into regenerative management, I'm not sure I was really into regenerative management as, you know, right away. I hate to admit it, but I dwelled too long on let's graze better to get more cow feed so we can run more cows. And Savory had always alluded to the fact that, hey, you're doing things in the soil, but he wasn't as clear on that as maybe either I didn't understand him as clearly, or he wasn't as clear on that as I think we needed to be. And I don't know. I went a long time before somebody at a where I was invited as a speaker in Missouri, and somebody with sitting at one of the discussion tables was making a bunch of comments about soil and soil health. And I got pretty engaged in that conversation. And then this guy says, hey, you just need to meet Gabe Brown. And so not too long after that, I was invited speaker at some event in Bismarck. And Gabe readily came up and he knew who I was, came up and introduced myself and vice versa. And we started getting acquainted, and boy, and it was the guy at that table that night, sure, right. I needed to meet Gabe Brown. And that's what I've got to say. And I can't remember the year of that, but that's when my journey into regenerative ag, what I would call true regenerative ag, changed. I remember a statement that Gabe made. He said, why would we want, he was being a little critical of the term sustainability. And I am too. I thought it was a good term once upon a time, but we've so misused it that it's horrible. But anyway, he said, why would we want to sustain a degraded resource? And I get thinking about that. You know, hopefully people don't, and they're trying to, but they don't ruin the term regenerative, mm-hmm. because we are regenerating. We're doing it again. It used to do it itself, you know, mm-hmm. long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was self-organizing and it was self-correcting and it was self-sustaining. And it could recover from climatic setbacks, et cetera. And so self-regulating, it did all of those things. And I, you know, it took me too long to understand that. I had actually retired from a career at Deseret, and I think where we did some pretty good things before I really started to put soil first and to get in a true, what I call a true regenerative mode. So it took me too long. You young people out there listening, you don't have to take that long. There's a good number of us who've been down the road long enough, made enough mistakes that your journey can happen a lot faster than mine did.
Yeah, I think that's why the phrase standing on the shoulders of giants matters, you know, because you guys built such a great foundation for us in the economics and finance and people management and the cows and the management of cows and some of those things, that a lot of that we get to start with that in our back pocket. And then we are able to, and we're freed up to, because of the good systems that were built by guys like you, we're freed up to focus on the soil health and some of those things. And then, who knows what the next generation will get to focus on, but we're always indebted to the people that have gone before us that have put good systems in place. So, very much appreciate that.
Yeah, the one thing I might add to what I've just said is that this just all highlights the importance of ecosystem processes. I knew them. I knew what they were. And I thought a little bit about them. You know, when I knew we wanted litter on the soil surface, that's the term I was using back back in those days, I sort of knew why, get more rainfall into the ground. But I wasn't even beginning to understand how those processes were so interconnected and so interrelated. And when you don't just affect one of them at a time, we like to kind of think about them one at a time because we are kind of linear thinkers, because that's the way we've always been taught. But boy, when that raindrop goes into the ground rather than run across the ground or get evaporated, magic starts to happen. You know, I hate to use that term magic, but it's as close to magic as you can imagine, just because of the interconnectedness of all of the processes and how things begin to start to happen. And it's almost immediately, as you know, as we get more water into the soil, and those ecosystem processes are just so important. You know, water cycle, mineral or nutrient cycle, sunlight energy flow, and then the successional processes or biological community processes that create diversity. Below the ground, at the soil surface, the insects, the birds, the small animals, the large animals, and then the people who eat the product of that land, whether it be an animal product or a garden product or a wild berry product or whatever. But, you know, health starts at the soil and works its way up. And it's all through ecosystem processes and how they function. And everything we do, positive or negative, has an effect on those ecosystem processes. We need to learn through our observation and through a lot of observation of other people and mistakes that we've made, many of us have made, how to push those ecosystem processes forward rather than backward.
Yeah, and you've spent the majority, as I understand it, of your career kind of west of the 100th meridian. And in those places, most people would probably tell you their limiting factor is the amount of rainfall. But if you're still getting runoff, if you're still having water run off of your land rather than infiltrate into it, really your limiting factor is water infiltration. It isn't necessarily rainfall, because if you're not keeping every drop you get, then it doesn't really matter how much you get.
Or evaporate from bare ground.
Right.
Or from an inch down into that bare ground. When you don't have it covered and cooled, the soil temps can just be so much higher in exposed soil than they are in covered soil. And I recall an interesting conversation with somebody, and we were talking about grazing and kind of introducing ourselves to each other. And I don't even remember where this guy was from, but where he was from made me curious. And I said, "How much rainfall do you get?" And he said, "All of it." And then he grinned and he said, "No, I'm not that good yet." But he said, "We are getting a lot more of it than we used to get." And it just made me think, let's say you're in a 15, 16, 17 inch rainfall area. And I've spent a lot of my time in those kind of areas, or less, even down to 8 and 9. But let's say 15 or 16, and I'm only getting half of it. Maybe not even that. But let's say because of evaporation, runoff, et cetera, I'm only getting half of it. And now I start doing things that I change that half. So I was getting 7 inches. I got 8 left of potential. If I can get 4 of those 8, what have I done to my production potential? You know, and as I change that and change the sunlight energy flow and everything else that begins to happen, the microbiome starts to change. Everything starts to work better. The mycorrhiza starts to work and transport nutrients and water in the soil. Oh, my. The magic that begins to happen is just incredible. And, you know, so those kind of things are really, really important.
Yeah, you've talked about kind of the process that you went through as far as changing your mind. How do you approach helping ranchers change their minds?
You know what? I wish that were easier. I'm probably not as good as that as I'd like to be.
It's about the hardest thing in the world to change.
It is.
That paddock between your ears, right? That's the hard
part. But there are some things I encourage. I try to encourage people, you know, if they show any inclination toward open-mindedness at all. Now, if they don't, I probably don't work with them very much. I hate to admit that, but I'm old enough, and there's enough people out there willing that I'd rather focus my attention there. But if they show any inclination at all to want to know more, I encourage them to visit good ranchers who are having some success with regenerative ag and regenerative management. And then I try to encourage them to attend Soil Health Academy and to watch and read the materials produced and made available by Understanding Ag. They can do that kind of thing and do it well. And those are the resources. And I just encourage people to take advantage of the resources that are available, the people that have been successful, and just to listen and see what you can learn. See if that can be encouraging. But I think that for me, the most encouraging at all was to go and see. Maybe I'm too much of a doubter, but I can believe what I can see easier than I can believe something that somebody just told me. And so if I really try to get people to go see good examples, even if it costs them a little money to do that. And I have occasionally organized some tours for some people that wanted to go see. And I think really it made believers out of them. It made the breakthrough in their mindset to get them to come forward with a better mindset so that they could then become lifelong learners and begin to work on practices that obey these principles.
Yeah, you talk about working with closed-minded people and maybe not always investing as much time as you might somewhere else. And it brings to mind, I think, something my dad told me when I was dealing with a horse that wasn't working out quite like I thought he should. There's too many good horses in the world to own a dangerous one. So,
yep, that's right. No, and you know, they're just good examples out there. And I think if people show any inclination at all to want to know, to want to find out, if we can direct them to good examples and then to Soil Health Academy, I think that's really important. And that's not to undermine the value of some of the other schools. I mean, I'm a big proponent of ranching for profit, but you know, they do very little with the grazing and the soil health and Understanding Ag just has what it takes on that part of management.
Yeah. You know, they've got one day or half a day, maybe on the ecology, as far at Ranching for Profit, where Soil Health Academy can spend 3 days on that. And so I think it's a 1-2 right. punch. I don't, you know, I think it's not an either or, it's a both and approach. If you're going to be a lifelong learner, you've got a lot of time to go learn.
I got friends in all those other places, you know.
Yep.
HMI, they still do their thing. And I know Kirk Gadzia from years and years ago, he's still there, still in trucks, still teach schools. You know, there's others that I've met more recently that are teaching there, but, and I think, you know, in a lot of ways do a lot of good, but. As I've endeavored and worked hard to try to learn the principles of soil health and understand them and try to understand what goes on biologically in the soil and how it recuperates from winter and things like that, I'm just very convinced that if you want to learn soil and how that interacts with your grazing practices or your farming practices, Understanding Ag and Soil Health Academy are the place to go.
Very good.
But if you can visit ranchers who have been exposed to all of that and are doing it pretty well, I think that can be the mind shift for you.
Yeah. The even after the school, find some mentors who are doing those things and get on their place and see it in action.
Exactly.
Yep. Very good. I'd like to make a little bit of a shift here and talk about some things related to production. You said we like to talk about that in the previous episode, and it is everybody's favorite thing, but we also talked in the previous episode that sometimes our time spent managing our production can be wasted. And so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that you have learned over the course of your career with regard to production and management of production. And a couple of the things that you mentioned in the previous episode was talking about about cows and managing cows and the way that you started to approach developing heifers and some of those things. Did that end up playing a role in what it took to make cows or to create cows that really were successful in their environment as far as developing them on the ranch or finding them from places that developed them like you would want them developed?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I can tell you what we did in Nebraska. I was at those ranches longer than any others in my entire career. And we wanted the cows to be adapted to where we were. And there's probably no shortcut to this story, so I'll just tell it the way it is. We made a high percentage of our own bulls right there on the ranch. We wanted the cows to be adapted. And so we took a while to move from March calving to April calving during the time I was there. April calving fit us a lot better than March did. April 1 maybe was a little early, but it worked. We made it work for us pretty well. That ranch now starts calving the 1st of May, which I think is probably 10 days later than it should have been. But I don't know that. Optimum calving season has that has to be determined at each ranch, and a whole thing set of factors apply there. I helped some people just before I retired put a ranch together. Actually, they're part of our company, but a different location. Helped just get it started and put together, and I suggested that their calving season maybe ought to start the 20th of April. And so they did, and they used it for years, and they still do. The last time I talked to their manager there, again, who was, as a young manager, worked under me, but I said, how do you like your calving season? He said, when I'm calving, I think we're calving too early. He said, we're still not past the danger of a bad spring snowstorm. He said, we won't have one very often, but we're still not past that danger. And he says, so that's a constant worry when we're calving, especially until we get into May always. And he said, but when we're breeding and we're doing that out in August and the grasses are starting to turn, I think we're calving too late. And I said, well, if that's your worry, maybe you're calving about the right time. You know, but those mm-hmm. are the questions. If you're breeding late on fall feed, is that feed good enough to get you good conception rates? And I've had some experience with June calving that wasn't really too good myself for breed back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a tightrope to walk there for best reproduction. And I think reproduction is the key. I think that's really what you want to be good. And I think even more important, it's no problem, especially in the places that I've managed. If you get north of I-70, especially north of I-80, a cow nursing a calf from May 15th to July 15th is going to gain a lot of weight, unless she's a milk cow, and you don't want those kind of cows either. So anyway, we kind of evolved, and we moved our calving season the 1st of April. It might have been still a little too early, but we calved then, and then we started. Kind of a whole chain of events got us there, a lot of systems thinking and input from our crew. But we started keeping every heifer and exposing them, not every heifer. I mean, we'd call maybe 5% of just the poor heifers. The rest of them we exposed to the bull. But we started out at 30 days. We moved that to 24 days. And just that short exposure to see what would get pregnant. A lot of people said, well, why don't you do test on those heifers to see which ones the good ones are. And I said, I think the bulls and Mother Nature can tell me which one the good ones are better than those genomic tests. Mm. Now, I might be wrong on that, but I don't think so. If that heifer can get pregnant to calve in the first cycle, there's no way in the world those heifers that would have bred and calved later can ever in this life catch up with her. And it's this income now in the next few years that I'm concerned with. It's not what genomics will predict 10 years down the road. So I want a heifer that can breed and calve on time right away. So we bred them. We kept the ones that get pregnant. We were kind of lucky. We got in the 70s pregnant for the first time we did it. Hmm. And it moved into the 80s. Now, then everything started to roll in our favor pretty well. And we're putting all these heifers into the cow herd. We don't have room to keep all these cows now. So what do? Well, we started selling the later calving cows, regardless of their age. And I don't remember, it took us a little time to get there, but not too long. And basically, we would, at preg check time, we would tell the guys doing the pregnancy testing, if that pregnancy occurred after the 1st of September, she's an open cow. Even if you palpated something, she's open. Mm-hmm. And so they called her open. We marked her open. On our record, she was open. She did not count into our pregnancy rate. Mm. But we knew some of them were pregnant because we pulled the bulls the same day we pregged the cows. A lot easier to tend bulls in a cow herd than it is in a bull herd. Mm-hmm. And plus, they were there. They were convenient. It was easy to get them off. And so she was an open cow. And we'd take those cows to corn stalks and we would preg them in December after we'd put bulls back in them at the end of November to breed them for fall calving. But we'd preg check them in December, and any cow pregnant then, she was going to be a June or July calver next year. We found a buyer that bought those from us routinely. Hmm. And he was a buyer that only terminal crossed because he was using his cows for recip cows for embryo transfer. And he told me he liked our cows because he said they're a good foster mother. And he said, if they don't catch with the embryo and we breed them to bulls, he said they raise a good calf of their own. And so they just kept coming back and buying those cows year after year. And, you know, an easy way to sell your late calving cows. And those are cows that a lot of people would just say, hey, they would have pulled the bulls at the end of 45 or 60 days. And she'd have been an open cow and they'd have just sold her in the cull cow market. We didn't take cull cow price for those cows. Mm. So, you know, and then in the spring, and this date probably changed. I can't remember exactly how we did it to get there, but we got to where any cow that calved after the 1st of May was set into we gathered them up from all of our herds, and we had a fair number of herds. We had about 7,000 cows. We'd put those in a herd by themselves and breed them to calve next year in May. They were calving this year in May, bred them to calve in May. And we found a guy who would buy those cows and he would buy them off the end of the preg chute that fall. We'd wean the calf, preg the cow, and he would take them, haul them away from the corral. We never took them back to pasture after we preg. And so that was a pretty cool deal. And it was a revenue driver. But anyway, so our cows are starting to get a little more adapted. And now we're raising our own bulls. So how are we doing that? Well, a cow had to calve in the first cycle for her first two calves, raise an acceptable calf in both of those calves. And now she's pregnant to have her third calf coming 4 years old. She then, if she was pregnant, appeared she was pregnant to calve in the first cycle as a four-year-old and had calved in the first cycle as a one and a, or as a two-year-old and a three-year-old, she was eligible to go into our seed stock herd. So we'd set those cows aside, say, okay, they're all eligible based on what we know about them. Calves were acceptable and they bred on time. Now, we'd get them all together and we always had a few more than we needed to replenish our seed stock herd to keep it stocked. And then we would look at them for udders or any other kind of blemishes, eye problems, any lameness at all, anything that would say, hey, we don't want her to be the mother of a bull. We just look for other things that we could see visually that would be against her. We take those off, and if we still had more than we need, then we might look for color markings or things like that we'd make them less desirable to a buyer. But then those became the mothers of bulls. And we had a herd of about 600 from which we needed to produce about 100 bulls. We would AI in that herd, and about half of the semen we would use in there was purchased semen outside bulls, and about half of it was semen from bulls we had raised. over time, we found that the bulls we had raised, they produced calves that weaned just a few pounds lighter, but not much, a few pounds lighter than the cows, than the outside bulls. The outside bulls, their daughters stayed in our herd better. The bulls we raised, their daughters stayed in the herd better than the daughters of the outside bulls. So daughter retention was better. And we just felt like we were getting adaptation to our environment. And we were letting Mother Nature tell us which cows could stay and which cows should go. You know, we looked at things like udders. We looked at feet and legs. And can she walk? Basically, can she walk and get pregnant and stay healthy? Oh, another thing, we had a what we called a bad marking system. It was just a notching system. If we ever had to touch a cow or her calf, she got a single notch. That meant she could never be the mother of a bull. If she did anything wrong, we had to touch her again, she got a second notch. Also, if she had a hard pull at birth, she got two notches at once. That meant she was for sale. Two notches, she's for sale. And we didn't sell her to these buyers that were buying our good productive cows, you know, that were just a little late. But it's two notches, she's for sale. One notch, she can never be the mother of a bull. So as we were making up our cows to be bull mothers, to go into our seed stock herd, she couldn't have a notched tag or she wasn't eligible to go. So anyway, that's kind of how we work toward adaptation. And I am a firm believer your cows need to be adapted to your environment. If they are, they'll get pregnant. You won't have to doctor them. They won't have problems. They'll calve on time for your calving season. And they'll adapt to your grazing management. As your grazing management gets better, the cow might not have to be quite as tough, quite as durable as when the grazing management wasn't good. But that will all move in sync with your environment if you're doing both programs together, good grazing management and good cow culling and bull selection. They'll all come together.
Yeah, you've talked about bull selection and genomic testing here in the last couple of minutes. And when most people think about bull selection, I think the first thing that comes to their mind is probably EPDs. Can you tell me a little bit about how you think about EPDs?
I can. You know, they work depending on how you use the word work. If you want more weaning weight, they'll give you more weaning weight. If you want more yearling weight, they'll give you more yearling weight. If you want an all-around cow, you've got to be awful careful about whether they work or not. There's a few people claiming that now that they've got some EPDs that work. And maybe they do. To a certain degree, they might. And might be better than nothing. But basically, when I use EPDs, if I'm going to buy a bull to AI to, or buy a bull from outside just to keep inbreeding coefficient in our herd from creeping up, so I want to add some outside genetics. And I only want outside genetics for two reasons. One, we may have a weakness in our herd that kind of spreads across the whole herd that I'd like to correct. And if I could find a bull that I thought could correct that weakness, I might do it. And sometimes the EPDs might help with that. And sometimes, say, for example, our carcasses just aren't good, I might be able to fix that with some EPD work. But sometimes if I've got a herd fertility problem or a problem with immune system, my cattle just aren't as healthy as I'd like. Well, first of all, I'm going to crossbreed for sure to take care of those kind of problems. But second of all, I'm going to look for something that's pretty darn fit, and that they never have to doctor, they never have to treat. So I'll go to breeders that do that, and I'm going to kind of ignore the EPDs. But if they do have EPDs on bulls that I'm selecting for, I'm probably going to look at height to put a lid on it, not to get more of it. I'll probably look at calving ease, maternal and calving ease direct, and try to keep some balance between those two. I don't want extreme in either one, because extreme calving ease direct will tend to constrict the pelvic area of the daughters, because the only way you're going to get better calving ease direct is it got to be smaller. And a smaller pelvis can have them. So over time, you're allowing smaller pelvis heifers to come into your herd. Calving ease direct makes the pelvis bigger. And the only way you make the pelvis bigger is to make the cow bigger. So you know, you got to have some balance between those two, and so I'll watch for that. But basically, I just like to know the history. What was mama? Did you ever have to pull a calf out of mama? Did she always calve in the first cycle? Most, and I hate to say it, most seed stock breeders can't tell you that without going to the records.
Right.
Yeah. And so you got to be real careful in bull selection. I'm just not big on EPDs anymore. I'll use them for a few things once in a great while. They will make, you know, on a single trait, they'll make cattle do what you want them to do. But I don't think there's very many good maternal EPDs out there. You know, some people are starting to make some claims that might make some sense, but I don't know. I just think if they breed on time and never get sick, there is an acceptable calf, and they do it without much supplementation and virtually no care from you, they're a pretty good cow.
And we talked a lot about bulls here. You talk about raising your own bulls and some of those things, and we're right in the thick of bull sale season as we record this. And, you know, I've been hearing averages $5,500, $5,600. I heard an average yesterday of a sale that was $8,100. So I don't think the bulls are getting any less expensive anyways. And earlier on in the previous episode, actually, you talked about herd fertility being one of the things that you really want to keep an eye on. When we have a really fertile herd, does it get to the point where you can start to use a lower bull to cow ratio? Or is that something that maybe is not the risks outweigh the gains in terms of messing with bull to cow ratio?
I think it depends on where that bull comes from. If you've raised them on a low input situation, or and they come from your herd and they're used to no low inputs, I think that cow to bull ratio can get up there higher, you know, 30 and plus, where a lot of them are recommending 20 and even less. But good bulls, and I love composite bulls with some heterosis to them, that are properly developed will breed a lot of cows. And, you know, that's another thing. You buy a lot of these bulls now and they don't hold up. I can't deal with those high prices of bulls when I can probably produce them for $2,000 or less at home. And from all of my experience, have just as good a bull. Might not look as fancy, doesn't have a pedigree, but you know, they're good. We know it came from a good cow. We know it came from a pretty good bull. And we just let Mother Nature and the environment kind of select them. And they're pretty good. Now if you want a terminal cross, yeah, go buy you some good terminal cross bulls. You know, there's some breeds out there. Even the high growth, high carcass Angus are terminal cross bulls. They're not maternal.
Right.
But they you know, they could be used on a good composite cow that you just want a terminal cross and sell all the calves. It'll work. There's some Charolais bulls out there. Put some muscle in them and some carcass grade at the same time. There's some breeders that have got that done pretty well. When you do that, there's probably some reason to use the EPDs. But if you're wanting to make a cow herd that's truly a cow herd and you're making your own replacement heifers, they've just got to fit your environment. They've got to do it right there at your place.
Yeah, continuing down this road of some of these production, talking about some of the production things. Can you talk to me a little bit about some of the lessons that you've learned around processed feed costs and some of the ways that you've approached using those in the operations that you have been in charge of managing?
Well, we just wanted to graze as much as we could and hay as little as we could. I never did get to where we could get away without producing any hay because snow was always a risk. Weather was always a risk. Storability of the hay, you know, place I managed in Utah, why we had hay sheds and we baled hay, and there's some winters we hardly had to feed any of it except some good alfalfa hay, which we use as a protein supplement because we could get it there locally. And I love alfalfa as a protein supplement for we were grazing some pretty sad grass, and but we could graze all winter long. And again, that was an April calving season, and it didn't start right at the 1st of April, just into April a little ways. But if we'd have been asking those cows to graze that sad grass and trying to calve in February and March, first of all, there would have been no protection from the bad weather, which you certainly could get in that country then. And they just, they weren't going to be ready to rebreed on that kind of feed. They, you know, you needed to be later. So, but anyway, on that ranch, we'd sold all two ranches that I worked with. We sold all the hay and equipment. Well, I don't think we put, we contracted all the hay. Every ranch I was ever on, we contracted all the hay. We figured that, hey, we got a guy that he's assigned to cattle. He needs to take care of cattle. He needs to graze right. He needs to be observant. He's as busy as he needs to be taking care of cows. Why do I want to take him away from cows to put up hay? And so we contracted all of our hay. And I'm pretty convinced that most hay contractors don't know what it's costing them to put up hay. You know, and a lot of them are using equipment they use back on their own ranch. And they and so they can spread the depreciation further if they can put up hay for somebody else. And so I think that's why a lot of them do it. And but anyway, we always contracted it, and I thought that was the best. The other thing, feed as little as you absolutely can get away with. And with good grazing, you can replace more fed days with grazed days. And that's just a profitable move when you do that. And, you know, I already made the statement, you put a machine between the mouth of the cow and her feed source, and you've just added cost, just costs you money. And buying hay is usually less expensive than making your own. And that's not always the case, but it is quite often the case, especially if you're having to irrigate that hay to make it. We turned an awful lot of irrigated ground into pasture and bought the hay we needed for winter.
And did you usually graze that irrigated ground during what would have been the haying season anyways?
Yeah, we grazed it during what would have been the haying season. Yeah. And we, you know, we were trying to feed cows. Summer, some of those places were summer cows on essentially a desert. And we were trying to feed them at the time of the year when they could have been grazed in that desert. And so we grazed the irrigated lands at the time of the year when it was best to graze them. Well, we focused most of that grazing on yearlings. See, we were keeping a later born calf over his yearlings. And then, boy, we could make them really gain on that irrigated pasture. And we were trying to manage the grazing on that irrigated pasture pretty well too. And, you know, and because of the way these were all our own raised yearlings, and because they were, naturally you go through your first flush, and you know how irrigated pastures go, you're going to get a really good flush on the front end. And so there'd come a time in there that we would need to sort off the heavy end and ship them, and then keep the rest a little longer. But that's all right, because difference in calving season and age and so forth, maybe even some competition difference, the front end needed to go, and they weighed up pretty good. And then I'm convinced that back end would pick up the rate again after the others left, and then follow the rest of the season with the ones that were left. On some irrigated meadows that were basically flood irrigated, we did something a little different. And there was grasses, and there was a wide variety. And some of those grasses, they weren't the favorite for the yearlings to graze. So there was always residual there. And we grazed that in the dead of winter for the cows. And they'd graze the balance of that, and it made plenty good cow feed. Another interesting thing that can make a believer out of you. One of those places where we'd been grazing 7 or 8 years, and then we had a horrendous winter, and we had to feed up all of our hay stocks. And then we needed to decide, okay, are we going to buy enough hay to fill our barns again, or are we going to make some of our own hay? Well, it turned out with the number of stocker cattle we had, and the price of stockers was such that the best alternative economically was to just set aside some of our own pasture ground and hay it this year. And we picked a piece that it hadn't been hayed for 7 or 8 years. And in a country where a ton and a half of meadow hay, irrigated meadow hay, short growing season, 6,000 feet elevation, the average yield is about a ton and a half. year in, year out, if you were hanging that same ground year after year. We got just short of 4 ton to the acre. And I'm convinced that that year after year return of manure and urine and some trample and so on and so forth that happens, that happened on that irrigated ground, and this flood irrigated ground at that, just enabled that, you know, just had the whole world of the microbiome alive. And it just made it highly, highly productive. Now, the thing I wasn't able to do is to catch the number of ADAs we got off that pasture next year to see how much of a hit it took, because we harvested the hay and hauled it away. Now, we did try to feed back on that same area to get some of that return back, but probably never get it all back.
One of the things that we talked about is the relationship between cows per full-time employee or full-time equivalent. And I think that a lot of people are in a paradigm where 800 per FTE sounds like a lot. How did you guys make that work? What made that doable in the scenarios that you were a part of?
Well, basically just the fact that it was one herd. You know, I don't care if the herd's 200, 400, 600, or 800, or 1,000. It's just not that much more work to take care of them. You know, the temporary fence work might take a little more time, but you're doing that while you're there anyway. Now, if you got one man taking care of 800 cows in one herd versus taking care of 800 cows in eight herds, oh, the difference in his time requirement is humongous. I mean, the 800, we for a few years were having a little scour problem, and we started using the Sandhills calving system. I don't know if you've heard of that or not, but you move the heavies ahead of your cows that have calved. And you do that about every 10 days. You just move them ahead, because it's the new calf that if it's exposed to scours, it's going to get it and die. And the calves left behind, they're getting older every day. And if they haven't had any scours, well, if they do get some, they're going to be pretty tough and resilient and deal with it. So you're moving these cows ahead. Well, sometimes we'd get into many before we'd start recombining them again, we'd get as many as five or six herds for that one herd. I'll tell you, boy, our cowboys, they were gosh awful anxious to get them back together. They'd want to see how many rules we could break, you know, how soon can we combine and how, you know, and where and all this sort of thing. So we had some rules, you know. If the youngest calf in the second calving herd was 10 days old and neither herd had any scours in, we'd combine them to fresh ground. But so we had things like that, we had some rules that we'd live with, and we'd start fudging on the rules a little bit, but not a lot, because that calving method is better than any medicine going, I'll guarantee it. And it just works. But boy, the guys that were calving, we didn't have assisted births on our cows, but they were so anxious to get those cows back together so they could manage them in one deal that it was amazing. It's really the number of herds that takes time. And it's not that one herd gets bigger. Yes, a little time, yes, but not a lot.
I'm not sure I've ever seen 800 cows in one place outside of a feedlot or a sale barn. So, but it's always seemed to me like it was going to be stockmanship that made quite a bit of the difference as far as...
Good stockmanship helps. There's no question, especially when you're calving and things like that, and you need to move them. But even poor stockmen, though, once their cattle are used to moving, even poor stockmen can get them to move. If they know they're coming to fresh feed, they're going to come. But that's a poor way to move cattle. You move them with good stockmanship, and the people with good stockmanship, they have so much better luck in handling those cattle. And then when it's time to take them to the pens, you know, two or three people can take them to the pens and they can pen them, and they don't have run backs or anything like that. They can pen them and they can work them and they can do what they need to do.
Very good stuff here today over the last couple of episodes that we've put together here. I really appreciate your time. Any final thoughts or anything else that you wanted to add or that's come to your mind as we've been talking?
I might just do a little quick review of the stuff we did 2 weeks ago, if that's all right.
Yep.
Not very much, but you know, there's four things we got to manage. We've got to manage our production, our economics and finance, our marketing and people. We can just remember that. I had a list that I gave of things that were major determinants of profit. Each person individually needs to decide which of those has the heaviest weight at his place, because the biggest mistakes people make is not recognizing their leverage points. And these are all key leverage points for profitability. But depending on where you are, your marketing situation, and a whole bunch of other things, some of them carry more leverage than others. People need to learn which of those determinants of financial success have the greatest leverage. You know, is it enterprise mix and choices? Is it overheads? Is it stocking rate? Is it fed feed versus grazed feed? Is it calving season? Is it fertility? Is it wise use of inputs? Is it marketing? Which of those? You notice I didn't put weaning weights in there. And the reason I didn't, weaning weights always come with a cost. And they usually aren't a big determinant of profit. But anyway, they need to know where those leverage points are. That's really, really important. And then the summary would be this: reduce overheads. No matter what you do, reduce overheads to the bare minimum. Increase turnover. Be able to produce more off of your piece of ground, off of your ranch. And it can be multi-species. It can be changing the enterprise. It can be better management of the soil and grazing management. And then market well. Market as best you know how and as best you can learn how. And then those three key ratios: acres per cow, cows per full-time equivalent of labor, and fed feed versus graze feed. If you can do those things well, you will be a profitable rancher.
Very good, Burke. That's going to be for sure in the running for the best 2 minutes of the Working Cows podcast. So I really appreciate that summary. Very, very good. And I will put that list, if you're okay with it, I'll put that list up in the show notes page for people so they can go to workingcows.net/299 or workingcows.net/302 and find that list there. And then they can kind of start analyzing that list and figure out which one of those major or key determinants is most important for their ranch. But Burke, if there's anything else, I'll just say thank you for your time today.
You bet. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Very good stuff there, as always, with Burke Teichert. Really appreciate him, really appreciate his perspective. I've had an episode up for a couple of weeks on Patreon. I thought it was timely information, and I put the whole episode up as an early release. And so I will be releasing that as episode 303, coming your way real soon on another episode of the Working Cows podcast. It is a conversation that I had with Don Day. And really what this conversation boils down to is the long-term predictability of drought. Can we know the cycles that, you know, the climate and the environment goes through, and just part of the natural processes of the earth being the earth, and kind of predict some of these droughts on a fairly regular basis, and then make management decisions based on that. And as I said in the outro to Monday's episode, I don't know what the Venn diagram of listeners between the Working Cows podcast and the Working Ranch radio show are, but Don was on there and he made some interesting statements quite a while back at this point. And so I wanted to give him an opportunity to share that with my audience. And he had some really interesting things to say, and I'm really looking forward to sharing this episode with the world. It will be episode 303 of the Working Cows podcast with Don Day. And we will see you again real soon with that next episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.